Are humans causing the sixth mass extinction?
You know, when people have gone back and tried to look at the end Permian extinction, which is the worst mass extinction of all time, they've calculated, you know, how fast was carbon dioxide being emitted during that extinction event. And it's roughly at the same rate that we are emitting it now, just by driving around and powering our power plants.
That's science reporter Elizabeth Colbert. We talk with her about her book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Many think humans could be on the extinction list, too. But
we see this pattern of death, but we also see a pattern of survival. If you look back at the fossil record, you can see what kinds of animals and other life forms have survived these catastrophic events. And for better or worse, humans actually match the profile of a survivor species.
That's Annalee Newitz. We talk about the prospects for human survival amid the mass extinction we're causing. Her book is Scatter, Adapt, and Remember. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The last time a mass extinction happened on Earth, an asteroid crashed into the Gulf of Mexico and started a chain of events that wiped out the dinosaurs, as well as many other species. This time, we are the asteroid. Scientists estimate we're now losing species at 1,000 to 10,000 times the background rate, with literally dozens going extinct every day. That's according to the Center for Biological Diversity. Between 10 and 50% of all species could be gone by mid-century. My guest, Elizabeth Colbert, has been reporting on this terrifying prospect for The New Yorker magazine. Her book, The Sixth Extinction, came out in February and is among the top-selling science books today. She says the causes are multiple, but they all stem from human activity. Global warming plays a major role, of course, but it's also ocean acidification, the mass cutting of forests and other ecosystems' degradation, and the global transfer of invasive species. In The Sixth Extinction, Colbert covers the history and science of mass extinctions and takes us along on her adventures in the field to find out what's happening to frogs, fish, corals, bats, and birds. And she speculates about what could happen to us. Elizabeth Colbert is a staff writer for The New Yorker. She's authored two previous books, one of which is Field Notes from a Catastrophe. Elizabeth Colbert, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
There have been five extinctions, major mass extinctions. You say that while, you know, life may be pretty much the same, I mean, of course, it has a variety, each extinction is very different in its causes. What are some of the different causes of the five extinctions that we've had?
Well, the most famous and probably the best understood is the fifth, which occurred at the end of the Cretaceous period. That's about 66 million years ago. It's the event that took out the dinosaurs and a lot of other, you know, groups that we're somewhat familiar with, the pterosaurs, for example, the ammonites. And it's pretty clear, there's a pretty significant scientific consensus that that was caused by an asteroid impact. An asteroid about the size of Manhattan slamming into the Earth. We know where the crater is. In fact, it's under the Yucatan Peninsula. So that's the cause, presumably, of the fifth extinction. The first extinction of these major mass extinctions of the last half billion years seems to have been caused actually by a cold snap, a sudden glaciation. There is evidence of that in many interestingly disparate parts of the world. And the third, which was the worst of all of them, the end Permian extinction, that was about 250 million years ago and did in something like 90% of all species on the planet, that seems to have been caused, and this is a very sort of ominous parallel, by a very significant release of carbon dioxide. No one is entirely sure from where. That caused a very significant episode of global warming. It caused the oceans to become acidified. The oceans also became anoxic, so huge, what we would call dead zones where there was no oxygen. So those are some of the causes that have been postulated for previous mass extinctions.
What's different about this one?
What's different about this, I suppose, is is that it's being precipitated, being caused by a species itself. Most of these seem to have been caused by what I guess you'd call geological forces. Now, we people, human beings, have become sort of the dominant force on the planet, and we are altering the planet really on the scale of these great, great geological events of the past. So, for example, right now, you know, when people have gone back and tried to look at the end Permian extinction, which, as I said, was the worst mass extinction of all time, they've calculated, you know, how fast was carbon dioxide being emitted during that extinction event, and it's roughly at the same rate that we are emitting it now just by driving around and powering our power plants. We are sort of imitating some of these great geological forces of the past, but we're also doing several different things at once, which I think is another a very significant problem. We're not just emitting carbon dioxide, though if we were doing that, it's quite possible we could precipitate a mass extinction just by doing that. But we're actually also doing other things.
And what are some of those other things that are driving extinctions?
Well, simply land conversion. That might be the most obvious and most well known to people. You know, if you mow down the rainforest and there are creatures that live in that rainforest that depend on that rainforest, you know, what extinction rates are pretty clearly going to soar. And, you know, that's definitely happening, especially as we increasingly do cut down tropical rainforests. It's important to keep in mind that the tropics are actually where most species live. That is where the great concentration of life on this planet is. And once you start messing around with those places, then you can really lose, you know, very significant proportions of your diversity pretty quickly. So that's something that we're doing, converting, say, the Amazon rainforest to soy plantations. We are moving things around the planet. This turns out to be a very significant driver of extinction, the extinctions that we've caused so far. We move a lot of species around the world, sometimes purposefully, and very, very often we do it by accident. And when you bring these creatures together that have evolved separately for many, many millions of years, you can get a lot of different outcomes, and one of those outcomes is it can be quite disastrous, and we are moving a lot of species around. There are estimates that every day 10,000 species are being moved around just in ship ballast water. So even if only a very, very small proportion of those species, you know, of those moved species cause a lot of damage to other species, if you're moving so many, clearly you're going to get problems. So many introduced species have, you know, and this is especially true on islands, have just run through the local fauna. Rats come to an island, they just eat, you know, the eggs of the birds there, the native birds there. Many, many bird species have gone extinct in this way. So that's another thing we're doing. So, you know, unfortunately the list is a fairly long one.
Your kids had a magazine with an article about frogs in it, and the extinction of many frog species was probably one of the first indicators, at least to the public, or at least to me, that we are in the midst of an extinction, that something's really going wrong. What's happening to amphibians, and why?
Well, amphibians are one of those really interesting cases of moving things around the planet. So what's become known as the amphibian crisis was first noticed in the 80s, the late 80s. People went out to find frogs and toads in places where they had always found them. Some of these places were quite remote, and they just weren't there. Suddenly, you know, from one year to the next, basically, they simply weren't there. And this really perplexed people because, you know, while you might say, okay, if we filled in this pond or if we cut down the forest, you could imagine impacts, but here we are, we're going back to this place that looks very similar and to the way it did last year, and yet there are no amphibians here. And people really puzzled over it, and it took several years for them to figure out what was going on. And sort of interestingly or ironically, the discovery was made actually at the Washington Zoo. Frogs at the Washington Zoo suddenly started to drop dead. And some pathologists began to look into it and found a fungus, that these frogs were infected with a fungus that no one had ever seen before. And the theory now for, you know, why this crisis is taking place and why this fungal disease has affected so many different populations in so many parts of the world is that it was moved around the world somehow on frogs themselves, so frogs that we move around the world for whatever purpose. And one of the theories of the frog that it might have moved around the world on is a frog called the African clawed frog, which used to be used for very early pregnancy tests. It was discovered all the way back in the 1930s that if you inject an African clawed frog with the urine of a woman who's pregnant, that frog will lay eggs in pretty short order. And so obstetricians used to keep tanks of these frogs around for pregnancy tests. And then a lot of them either got loose or were let loose. They formed these naturalized populations all around the world. And African clawed frogs are infected with this fungus, but they don't seem to drop dead from it. So they might have been carriers, as it were. But African clawed frogs obviously wouldn't have left Africa without people exporting them all around the world.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Elizabeth Colbert about her book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Another example of this, you kind of call this the new Pangaea, and you relate this also to bats. This is a problem that's happening in North America, the decimation of bat species.
Yes, the new Pangaea refers to the fact that about 300 million years ago, if you had been around, and obviously only our very, very most distant ancestors were around, you would have found all of the land masses in the world had sort of crashed into each other, sort of like a traffic jam of land masses. So owing to plate tectonics, for, you know, just whatever complicated random reason, all of the continents crashed into each other. And so there was one supercontinent, which has been given the name Pangaea, and then there was one ocean, so basically one continent and one ocean. And at that point, obviously, if you only have one continent, then everything's evolving on the same continent. And then Pangaea broke up, started to break up around, say, 200 million years ago. And since then, a lot of land masses have not touched each other, right, for the last 200 million years. So those flora and fauna have all evolved separately for that time, you know, for very long stretches of time. And the case of the bats, and by bringing these creatures together, so by bringing, say, the African clawed frog to North America, you're effectively bringing these fauna back together again, and that is why biologists refer to what we're doing as the new Pangaea. We're effectively, you know, biologically speaking, reassembling the supercontinent. And the case of the bats is not dissimilar to the case of the frogs, except that probably this fungus did not come across on a bat. It quite possibly came across just, you know, on someone's shoe or something like that. This is a fungus that kills bats. Once again, it just infects their skin. It affects hibernating bats who go into caves or mines during the winter, and their immune system shuts down. This fungus eats away at their skin. It's very irritating to them. They wake up, they fly around, there's nothing for them to eat, and they have very limited fat stores to get through the winter on, and they drop dead. And they have dropped dead, you know, by the millions. And I have been to places where you find, you know, hundreds of thousands of dead bats. I was just, in fact, in a cave in Vermont, which I visited several times. The first time I visited it, there were piles and piles of dead bats on the floor. By the next time I visited it, they had all decomposed, and the ground was just this carpet of tiny bones. Bats have very, very light, tiny, thin bones, as you can imagine. And this last time that I visited it, just about a week ago, there was still that same, you know, carpet of bones. There are some bats that have survived, a very small proportion have survived and still continue to hibernate in this cave, but the population has plunged probably by 90% or so.
What is that like to have seen that progression there?
Well, it's really brings home the idea. I mean, extinction, we usually notice it as just an absence. We go to look for that frog, and that frog isn't there. we usually miss because we are not, you know, in the right place at the right moment, because nature recycles itself very, very quickly. We usually miss that the moment of mortality for that species. So this was one of those rare events that scientists and even members of the general public, like me, have watched happen, you know, in real time. And if you can see that, you know, that's sort of one of your tip-offs that something very, very unusual is going on.
Now, you went to a place called Castelo Aragonese. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, unlike Pangaea, which now I know is pronounced Pangaea. That's a place with these vents where carbon dioxide has been being emitted for several hundred years at least, causing the phenomenon of ocean acidification. And you mentioned ocean acidification before with respect to the Permian extinction. And, of course, that's something that we're doing. Tell us about ocean acidification and why is it so dangerous?
Well, ocean acidification is sometimes called global warming's equally evil twin. And I think that is a very good description. It's maybe even too kind, to be honest. Maybe it's even more evil twin. So what you need to know about ocean acidification, without getting into the complexities of ocean chemistry, is simply that carbon dioxide, when it dissolves in water, forms an acid, carbonic acid. It's a weak acid. You know, you drink it if you have a seltzer or a Coke or any kind of carbonated beverage, but it is an acid. And that changes the pH of the water, which has, you know, just a potentially vast number of knock-on effects. And when we burn, you know, gasoline or coal or oil or natural gas, and we put carbon dioxide up into the air, that a lot of that ends up in the water simply because of this exchange of gases that occurs at the surface of the oceans, and the oceans have a vast surface area, roughly 70% of the planet. So let's say about a third of our carbon dioxide emissions are ending up in the oceans in relatively short order, dissolving and forming an acid. So the pH of the oceans has already changed by a significant amount, and if we continue down this path that we're on now, they will change by an even more significant amount. And when you're a marine creature and your only interaction with the outside world is through the water, you know, it would be very much like changing the composition of the air for us. And if you change the composition of the air for us in a significant way, you could imagine that things would get pretty ugly.
Yeah, and you say that we are reaching what could be a tipping point by 2100. I mean, that's not very far away. And is this a process that we can even contain at this point?
You know, everything is dependent on whether we continue to pump CO2 into the atmosphere. You know, if we do, then, you know, this is a very, ocean acidification is quite a predictable process. If you know that if you put up X amount of CO2, this is how much ocean chemistry is going to change. So that is really up to us. So when we say, well, there's a tipping point in the system, and in that case, this refers to reaching this certain pH where it seems like a lot of creatures can no longer tolerate the ocean chemistry. Beyond that, that is really still up to us whether we are going to reach that tipping point, whether we continue to emit CO2 to that point.
You also go to the Great Barrier Reef, to One Tree Island, where you experience the corals. That, you know, the corals, a lot of them are bleaching and dying, but you found some amazing biodiversity there.
Yeah, I went to the Great Barrier Reef, which is really, I have to say, I think of all the places I've been in the world, the most spectacular. For anyone who, you know, many of us have seen sort of films of reefs, and so people are familiar with the incredible diversity of life that exists on a reef. To actually see it, to be in the water with all those creatures sort of looking down on this shimmering world of life, very colorful, just spectacularly beautiful, is quite astonishing. And you realize that you you just don't see anything like that on land. Even if you're in the Amazon rainforest, which I have been in, you really don't see anything like this. Most creatures are, you know, hidden behind the greenery, but if you look into the water, you just see this amazing panorama in front of you. It's sort of so extraordinary. It strikes you as unreal and one of those ironies of the natural world.
I read recently that although the corals are grievously threatened by ocean acidification, that there are in fact a few coral colonies that are thriving, even with increased acidification. I guess the question is, can species evolve in time, at least some of them, evolve in time to survive what we're doing to them?
Well, I think that any, definitely creatures will evolve. I mean, there are many different, not many, I shouldn't say there are many different responses, but there are different possible responses to change. And they don't have to be evolutionary responses. You know, organisms have a certain amount of leeway depending on their genetic makeup to respond in different ways. So what happens when we see some species are doing okay under these circumstances, what that tells us is not that they've evolved. It's extremely unlikely that they've evolved to cope with what we are throwing at them, because there just hasn't been enough time, unless you're, you know, basically like a yeast bacteria or whatever that goes through multiple generations very quickly. There hasn't been enough time even, you know, for organisms like corals to evolve in response to human-caused ocean acidification. So what you're seeing there is that certain creatures, because of where they live and, you know, have in their genetic makeup the ability to cope with conditions that other species can't cope with. And that, you know, completely makes sense. Some creatures live where it's very hot. Some creatures live where it's very cold. There's just a wide range. And some species have different populations that live in different places and have different adaptability to different circumstances. So I think that the important thing here vis-a-vis coral reefs is, you know, even if you have some species that can thrive and they can, you know, sort of form mini reefs, a really significant reef like the Great Barrier Reef is made up of, you know, dozens, maybe hundreds of species of coral. It's not sort of a monoculture. So you might have small reefs that survive, and certain kinds of coral will take over. They will just take over because they're the only ones that can survive. But you will not have the extraordinary diversity that you had. You will no longer have something like the Great Barrier Reef. And I think that not even the most, you know, sort of optimistic person who says, okay, well, we have found, you know, all these papers that you read, someone says, okay, well, we have found this species can survive or that species can survive. But it is always, you know, with the understanding that that is just one out of, you know, for that one, there are many, many that can survive.
Elizabeth Colbert is my guest. We're talking about her best-selling latest book, The Sixth Extinction. Now, there are some things that scientists are doing to save species. You point to the insemination of the incredibly endangered white rhino. You also point to a kind of germplasm arc, a DNA arc that is being formed. I'd like you to talk about that.
The Frozen Zoo, which you're referring to here, which is in outside of San Diego, as you say, it's just a bunch of vials of germ lines, cell lines from, in many cases, endangered animals. In one case, at least, that I know of, an animal that's already extinct. And the thinking behind that is you want to have that banked, that DNA banked, you know, in some cases maybe against extinction, in some cases against very small populations even. You're trying to preserve sort of whatever genetic diversity is out there now in this cryogenic form. Now, you know, what you could possibly do with that in the future is a very, very open question at this point.
My question is the habitat question. I mean, even if we can preserve animals in zoos, much less frozen zoos, what is the possibility of really rewilding or bringing back species if the habitat is no longer there for them?
Well, that's a question that many people ask. Why I visited a facility, for example, in Panama, where the frogs are being, you know, wiped out, and this really beautiful species, the Panamanian golden frog, is now extinct in the wild. But there are Panamanian golden frogs living in this sort of sterile, you know, environment, and there are some at zoos. Now you can say, well, why, you know, is this species going to spend the rest of its species life, however long that is, just never going outside? And because its natural habitat, in this case, is infected with this fungus, which unfortunately lives on even, you know, after all the frogs are gone. So, you know, that question of what are we doing, I think, is one that people are increasingly going to be asking themselves, and that gets very much to your point. You know, if we can never, are we preserving these animals for our own, because we like to look at them, because it makes us feel better, what, you know, because we think it's the right thing to do, what are we hoping for some future that, you know, we have a difficult time imagining, but, you know, who knows what the future is going to look like? All of these possibilities are out there, but these projects take tremendous resources, and, you know, you do have to ask, well, would we be better served trying to preserve animals out where they are? And I think everyone you talk to in the conservation biology world would say, yes, obviously we are. Unfortunately, in many cases, you get to this situation, in increasing numbers of cases, you get to the situation where that is no longer an option, and then what do you do?
And finally, I can remember the day that I realized that we were in the midst of the sixth major extinction. I didn't call it that, like you did your book, Elizabeth Colbert. But, you know, I called it the end of the world as we know it. And since then, I can say it never goes away from my mind. And I struggle with this psychologically. I can only imagine how, in writing this book, you must have struggled with this as well. You not just have written about it in this book, but you've been writing about it for a while and thinking about it. Could you talk a little bit about the psychological process of coming to terms with the times that we're in?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, and I have to say it's a question that I sort of purposely avoid in the book. I tried to take, you know, my own response and what your response is not at all a normative exercise in that sense. I really just try to put it out there and leave you with your response, which, you know, people will say is, you know, horror and you know, they can choose from a list of grim states, and I think that's perfectly appropriate, but I don't sort of try to tell you how you should feel or how you might, you know, cope with grim feelings, because that's sort of, you know, above my pay grade, really. I don't have the answers to those questions. I think these are, as you're suggesting, the shadow, you know, that hangs over all of us at this particular moment in Earth's history and in human history. And that's not changing. I mean, I feel fairly confident that, you know, things are going to get worse before they get better. So I don't have an answer to that. I don't have what you should do to make yourself feel better, or if you should make yourself feel better, you know, what is the appropriate response? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think I was asking for the prescription, but more just a sense of how do you cope with it? How do you deal with it? I guess writing books might be the answer.
Right, exactly.
And then just on a quick final question, because it is related to this, I live as if the end of the world is happening right now, which it is, in a sense, but it's also a very long process. What is your sense of the length of time that we could be dealing with this before, you know, we go extinct ourselves?
Well, I think, you know, the famous phrase, predictions are hard to make, especially about the future. You know, there are so many variables and also imponderables here. I mean, one of the big question marks here with an issue like climate change is, you know, how are people going to react to that? Not how are we going to react to it sort of biologically, but how are we going to react to it societally? We are, you know, very technically sophisticated. We are very clever. There are lots of things, you know, we could do to try to cope with the effects of climate change, and there are also lots of, you know, ways that we could destroy ourselves and each other in response to climate change. So I think that those are questions that are really, in some sense, impossible to answer.
Well, Elizabeth Kohlberger, I want to thank you so much for writing this book and talking with us about it. It is The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Thanks for being on Writer's Voice here.
Thanks for having me.
Science writer Elizabeth Kohlberg. You can read an excerpt from The Sixth Extinction by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, will humans survive the sixth extinction? And how? We talk with Annalee Newitz about that. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. It's a right-wing talking point that global warming and even mass extinctions are no big deal because, hey, they've happened before. They're natural. And anyway, they're God's will. So party on with the fossil fuels. Of course, as we heard in the first segment of today's show, we're the cause of the current mass extinction. And one big question is, are we going to bring down the human race with us? My guest, Annalee Newitz, has looked into the history of mass extinctions and consulted her crystal ball to answer the question. We've dodged the bullet before, she points out. There was a time when humans almost went extinct. Newitz says if we're smart and follow the lessons of history, we'll probably survive this time too. We could even thrive, especially if we become stewards of the earth, not its destroyers. Her book's title hints at the prescription: Scatter, Adapt, and Remember. Newitz says we need to prepare individually for catastrophe, but even more importantly, we need to get ready as a planetary community. Welcome to Writer's Voice, Annalee Newitz. Your book, Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, makes a point that species extinction is a fact of life. And even Homo sapiens has gotten close to it, but survived. In other words, life goes on. But that's not to say it's okay for humans to be causing the sixth mass extinction.
I think the issue isn't really whether it's okay or not for us to be doing it. The real issue is what the consequences will be for us if we do it, and if we continue to make changes in the environment that kill off a lot of species. Maybe they won't kill off humans, but by wrecking animal habitats and plant habitats, what we do is we set up a future for ourselves that's going to be full of starvation and all kinds of other problems, because the more we destroy environments, the more we destroy food supply. And I think that's one of the things that people don't realize when they think about things like habitat change and climate change, is that ultimately what we're doing is we're messing things up for ourselves by messing up ecosystems for other life forms.
Annalee Newitz, your book has a fascinating treatment of the history of extinctions on this planet, but the point of it is to show that species can survive, which holds out hope for us.
We see this pattern of death, but we also see a pattern of survival. If you look back at the fossil record, you can see what kinds of animals and other life forms have survived these catastrophic events. And for better or worse, humans actually match the profile of a survivor species for a lot of different reasons. But the main reason is that we are incredibly adaptable. We can really adapt well to almost any environment, partly because we're such good tool users. And so that means that we're a candidate species for survival as we enter a new phase of extinction. But it also means that because we are such good tool users, I think that it behooves us to start thinking about how we could actually prevent a mass extinction, not just survive it, because surviving it is going to be an ugly, terrible, awful experience and will probably result in billions of deaths. I think that we can start looking at the tools we have now, the scientific and technological tools, to do things like remediate the environmental damage that we've done and mitigate the changes that we've already made to the climate so that as many species as possible can survive along with us, because we need them as part of our ecosystems to make things comfortable and to have good food sources.
And I guess the key to some of that survival is in your prescription in the title, which is Scatter, Adapt, and Remember. You talk about survivalists versus people who are making some strategies for survival. Talk about the difference.
So I think survivalists, and now you have groups like preppers, for example, who I think are a very popular version of survivalism. And generally what they're looking at is individual survival, or survival for a small number of people, like a family or a small community. And their goal is simply to, you know, make it through an imminent, say, a government collapse, or maybe some kind of natural disaster that brings down the grid. And what I'm interested in my book is really survival for the species, not just for a few people living off the land in a forest, but for potentially 10 billion of us living off of a planet in the middle of a solar system. And how do we do that? How do we survive so that it's not just us and a few neighbors, but that it's actually all of our neighbors across the planet who live to see a better world in the future.
And is it even possible for the first to happen without the second? I mean, do you really think that, you know, despite all our efforts, that we could survive on a personal level, anything maybe longer than another Hurricane Sandy, for example, or some maybe epidemic, even in that case, do you really think we could survive without looking out for the larger community, not just the human one?
I don't think we can, no. I think that they're two very different strategies, though. I think we do need to have disaster preparation the way that survivalists and preppers do. And actually, I think there are a lot of great ideas that come out of that community about how to survive an immediate natural disaster and how to, you know, cope with something that's very near term. But I also think that over the long term, and when I say long term, I mean over the next couple thousand years, which is the scale at which these changes are taking place in our environments, we absolutely have to have a long-term strategy, and it definitely involves changing things like the kinds of energy that we're using, the kinds of fuel that we're using to power up our cities. It involves looking at, you know, changing the way we build human habitats, you know, and trying to build cities and towns which are much less destructive of the environment around them. And ultimately, we're not going to survive well as a species if the entire ecosystem we depend on dies around us, because that's how life functions on Earth. We function as part of ecosystems. We don't just live alone in a little bubble. We depend on our ecosystems for everything from food to nice weather and nice air to breathe. So we can't survive on our own.
In fact, you say that there's a threshold effect of extinctions that, you know, once you get past 40% of species, you're really talking about a mass extinction.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting statistic. So mass extinctions for scientists really only get to be called a mass extinction if 75% or more species on the planet die out. And that usually takes about a million years or more, because this is an enormous amount of death that you're talking about. But there is a theory held by some biologists that what you would see in a mass extinction is you'd see a slow attrition of species, kind of like what we're seeing now, although, of course, it's speeding up now. And once you reach the point where maybe 40% of species had died out, then suddenly you would see an incredible uptick, and that it might just jump incredibly fast from 40% to 75%. So you would see a really terrifying era of mass death at that point. And again, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of that is going to be caused by famine and starvation, because once a lot of animals and plants are dying off, all of the animals and plants that depend on those other life forms to live for food or shelter or whatever, they start dying off too. So it's a kind of extinction knock-on effect where our food webs, the webs of the eaters and the eaten, just fall apart. And so because we've never witnessed one of these things happen in real time, we don't exactly know how it would work, but it seems very likely that the more creatures go extinct, the more will continue to go extinct.
And you give the Permian extinction, that's the one that's called the Great Dying. Something like 90% of all species went extinct then. But you give it that as an example of what you're talking about here with the food web. And first of all, tell us what caused it, and then how is that an example of what you've just discussed, the food web?
So the worst mass extinction that's ever happened on the planet, as far as we know, occurred at the end of the Permian period about 250 million years ago. And there's a lot of theories about how it happened, but one thing we know for sure is that around that time, enormous volcanoes started going off in the area which is now Siberia. And at the time, the planet had just one giant continent, so this would have been taking place in the northern part of a mega continent. And those volcanoes didn't just release lava, they also released a lot of greenhouse gases and toxins into the atmosphere. And the eruption was probably going off for about 1,000 years, maybe on and off, maybe it was continuous. But we know from the volume of lava, which really would have covered basically all of Western Europe, that it was an enormous output of an eruption. So over time, what this did was basically the equivalent of what our Industrial Revolution has done to the planet. So much carbon was released into the atmosphere that temperatures changed. There was extreme ocean acidification, which killed off corals and killed off a lot of coastal life forms. Most land animals did not make it. Many plants didn't make it. Even insects didn't make it through. In fact, one geologist I talked to called the world after the end of the Permian slime world, because basically it was a great time to be slime because it was lots of dead bodies, and also it was just a great, great atmosphere for slime, but not much else. And one of the things that was particularly interesting in terms of how this mass extinction developed was that it's a great way of thinking about how life is destroyed when other life forms are destroyed. So basically, when you see these massive climate changes taking place in the Permian, first, a lot of the dying is among plant life and basic bottom of the food chain kinds of life forms, again, like coral is another good example. And so then any creatures that feed on those plants or feed on the ecosystems around the coral reef, they die out too. And then the animals that feed on those animals start dying out. And so you see pretty rapidly an unraveling of this food web, where even if a particular animal isn't killed off by the habitat changing, you know, maybe they can survive just fine in warmer weather, or they can survive just fine with a little bit less water. But if their food source dies out, they can't survive. And so, again, it really emphasizes how much every life form is connected to every other life form in order to make it through one of these terrible events. And, of course, they don't make it through, because the more that their food sources die out, the more that they die out. And by the end of this period, the Great Dying, there was really only one four-legged land animal that had survived. And there's still, it was called Lystrosaurus, and there's still a lot of mystery around why it survived, but we think it was because it had a food source that was managed to make it through. It was a burrower, so we think maybe it was surviving on things like roots and fungus. So,
if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Annalee Newitz about her book, Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. And I like that "will" there, because so often I think Well, maybe it's might if we're lucky. And let's now talk about some of the examples. Let's take the first one, scatter. You take the example of Jews as a lesson for us in how to survive an extinction. Now, of course, this was not a habitat extinction, but still there's a lesson of resilience there. What was that?
When I was looking for ways of thinking about how humans, as we face the future, might deal with the problems that we're having now, I looked to historical examples. And one of the things that's interesting about the story of how a small tribe known as the Jews survived throughout history despite being persecuted and killed off in a variety of regimes was that this group of people made it a credo that they would leave in times of danger and adversity and adapt to new cultures and new societies where they were more accepted. And it turned out to be a pretty darn good survival strategy. And it goes against a lot of our instincts as people. I think a lot of times when people are threatened, they feel like they should stay and fight. And it turns out that that's a good way to get killed. And if you really want your people to make it through whatever the adversity is, going to a new place is a better way of doing it. And there's actually been a number of recent studies of the genetics of contemporary Jews that actually links present-day Jews to people who fled from Rome about 2,000 years ago when they were kicked out for being Jewish. And so what we see there is, in some sense, evidence that running away from danger and moving to new places will ensure long-term survival for your group. 2,000 years of a line of people who survived by running away, basically. And there's no shame in that. That's a survival strategy. And I think that we need to really be adopting part of that strategy now, which is learning to adapt to our environments better and learning to explore our environments and figure out how we can make those environments more survivable. When I say learning to adapt to environments, what I mean is partly learning to make our forms of living in cities, for example, or our ways of consuming fuel, adapting those to the environment so that they're sustainable, so that we're not depleting the environment, but that we're actually forming a symbiotic relationship with it, either by using things like carbon neutral or carbon negative sources of energy, or by building homes that are much more in line with the area around them, which are, you know, made of partly biological materials, for example. And I think that by doing that, people can survive without a horrible disaster or a horrible population crash.
How are people going to get food on the scale that they need to match their population by living in cities?
I think that's a great question, and there's obviously going to have to be many different strategies. Obviously, right now, we can't continue with the way that we're doing agriculture. Agriculture at the moment is producing a lot of toxins. It's wrecking habitats. So we want to focus on figuring out ways of doing land management so that we're growing food, but we're doing it in a way that is sustainable for the land and that doesn't interrupt natural cycles of, say, animal migrations or doesn't interrupt local flora to the point where we're driving other types of plants extinct. The other thing that I really think we need to be doing is imagining cities as sources of food production as well as sources of food consumption. And I really take to heart Jane Jacobs' idea that cities only survive if they start producing the things that they consume. So we may be thinking a lot about urban farming, whether that's by creating farms that are very close to their cities, growing food in the cities, on roofs, or in homes. And I think that that extends to how we will get our energy as well. I can easily imagine a future city where people are growing biofuel at home. They might have a home bioreactor where they're growing algae, and the algae could be a food source. It could also be an energy source. And it would be a way of converting a lot of our waste into something that's really productive.
One of the questions I had in reading these really exciting ideas was a cautionary one, though, and that was about cost and also about the kind of society we live in. That is, you know, if we were all pulling together in a democratic way to accomplish these things, they seem to be that they would be more possible. But given the kind of inequalities that we have now, where are we going to get the money to make these transformations?
I think it's going to be gradual and it's going to be uneven because, as you said, we don't live in a perfect world where decisions are made democratically. We live in a very class-divided world where certain countries and certain classes in those countries own a lot of resources. So right now, what we're looking at in the developed world, and actually to a certain extent in the developing world too, are systems that resemble the carbon credit system. I don't know if we're ever going to get a carbon credit system, but we're going to be seeing more and more large corporations having to worry about that issue one way or another. And what we've also seen, which is incredibly encouraging, is that the technologies for doing things like harvesting solar energy are now becoming quite cheap. So it's now becoming actually cost effective to imagine a future where our energy infrastructure is based around solar rather than around fossil fuels. So I think it's going to be slow, and I think that, you know, over the next 200 years or 300 years, we are going to see humans completely changing the infrastructures of their cities and the infrastructures of the grid, the electrical grid, because there's simply not going to be enough fossil fuel left, and it's going to become more expensive to get that fossil fuel and less expensive to get it from solar and from wind and from biofuel.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Anna Lee Newitz about her book Scatter, Adapt, and Remember. It's about how humans will survive a mass extinction if we're smart enough to take some of the suggestions that are in the book. Now, geoengineering is a very controversial subject, and it's one that you go into in some detail. It holds out some promise, but also a whole slew of problems. Talk about the promise first, and then I'll follow up with the problems.
Sure. So geoengineering is a very speculative field of engineering right now, and it involves coming up with systems, whether they're technological systems or geological systems, to control our atmosphere and to a certain extent control our climate. And right now, almost all of these systems are aimed at remediating the damage that we've done to the climate. So it's a way of turning back the clock on climate change. And there's obviously a ton of promise here because the planet itself has gone through periods of global warming and global cooling. So we know that the planet is a kind of machine that periodically on its own goes through phases very similar to what we've induced now with our Industrial Revolution. So if we could just figure out how that giant Earth machine works and how the carbon cycle works, we might be able to intervene and start taking carbon out of the atmosphere in the same way that we've been putting it into the atmosphere. Well, in a different way, but, you know, that we would start being able to reverse this process that we began. So that's the promise. I would have to say that every responsible scientist I talk to who's working on this definitely sees it as very futuristic. This is not something that's going to happen tomorrow. There have been some illegal experiments with geoengineering that have already taken place, and all of them have actually been very disappointing. They haven't worked out, and partly that's because they were not fully thought through. So this is something that maybe in 100 years we might see happening after we've already made a lot of other changes in our lifestyles as humans.
So I want to ask you, when you started out doing this book, you kind of had the idea, well, you know, basically humans are screwed. But the whole book is really tending in a different direction. In doing this book, what was the biggest change or thought that changed you in doing it?
So I did start the book by thinking that we were basically headed to our doom, and that the fact that we seem to be entering into a new phase of mass extinction would mean something catastrophic for humanity. And what changed my mind was going back into geological history and really educating myself about the history of the planet and how these carbon cycles work over time, and realizing that a lot of what we're experiencing now is absolutely not out of the ordinary for the planet. What's different is that there is now a species on the planet which understands what's going on as the climate is changing and as droughts are becoming more common. As far as we know, there have been no species during these previous mass extinctions that figured out what was going on and actually had the tools to intervene.
Much less caused it.
Yeah. And, you know, indeed, actually, previous extinction events may have been caused by species on the planet. In fact, one of the earliest mass death cycles on the planet, which wouldn't necessarily qualify as a mass extinction because it took longer than your typical mass extinction, but when the first photosynthesizing organisms arose on the planet about 3 billion years ago, they were thriving in an environment that was mostly methane-based. So most of the creatures on the planet at that time preferred a methane-like atmosphere. But these photosynthetic creatures, which were mostly algae, put out a lot of oxygen. The output of their digestive cycle was free oxygen. And that oxygen was pollution at the time. It was something that destroyed the environment for these methane-preferring creatures. And so actually, our oxygen-rich environment was the result of a life form altering the carbon cycle, altering the atmosphere. And of course, we love it, right? We love oxygen. But our happy world of oxygen is the result of this kind of early life form polluting everything. So even our impact on the environment is nothing new in the cycle of the planet. So the real question is for us now, you know, what are we going to do about it? We figured out that we've perturbed the carbon cycle. We figured out that we can perturb the carbon cycle, which is a great piece of data. So now the question is, can we fix it so that things remain comfortable for humans and our ecosystems? And the thing about that is, it's not about bringing Earth back to a natural state. We have to remember that. This is really about intervening and doing something profoundly unnatural because the planet's natural state is change. The natural state is that the environment is always changing, things are always dying out, the carbon cycle continues to vacillate between greenhouse and ice house. We just like the ice house. So if we want to maintain our lives in a happy way, in balance with ecosystems, at some point we do have to prevent the planet from doing what it does naturally, which is to go through a greenhouse cycle. So we may have brought on that greenhouse cycle early, but preventing it from happening is going to be, in the long run, another unnatural intervention. It's just going to be one that's comfortable for us.
Well, that is fascinating, and the book is also fascinating. Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. Annalee Newitz, it's just been such a pleasure to be talking to you about this and even giving us a little bit of hope in the wider perspective.
Thanks very much.
Annalee Newitz writes about the intersection of science, technology, and culture in such venues as Wired, Popular Science, the Smithsonian Magazine, and more. She's the editor-in-chief of the science and culture site, io9.com. Read an excerpt from Scatter, Adapt, and Remember at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Our webmaster is Bill Way.